This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at hollywoodblends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is an actor, producer, and author who's appeared in many movies, including Airport 77, Seems Like Old Times, Uncommon Valor, Swing Shift, Cannonball Run 2, Weekend Warrior, Lena's Holiday, Roe vs. Wade, and two very special movies, That's Life and Dad, in which he appeared with his legendary father, two-time Academy Award winner Jack Lemmon, who's been immortalized in movies like Mr. Roberts, Save the Tiger, The Apartment, Irma La Douce, The Odd Couple, The China Syndrome, Glengarry Glen Ross, and of course, the greatest comedy movie of all time, Some Like It Hot. In fact, our guest portrayed his father in a reenactment of his time on the set of Some Like It Hot in the Marilyn Monroe biopic, Blonde. On television, our guest has brought us many memorable roles, including Checo in Brothers and Sisters, Richard Phillips in Duet and Open House, Jeff Cameron in Knot's Landing, and Martin Brubaker, better known as Brew, in Thunder in Paradise. On the stage, he starred in Barefoot in the Park, Shay, Love Letters, and his highly acclaimed one-man show, Twist of Lemon, based on his best-selling, highly compelling, and heartwarming 2006 memoir entitled A Twist of Lemon, A Tribute to My Father. He also wrote, produced, and hosted the wonderful documentary film Magic Time, which is all about the brilliant artistry of Jack Lemmon. I am delighted to welcome Chris Lemmon to our show. Chris, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, Harvey, thank you so much for having me.
Chris, I must tell you that I was very moved by your book because you allowed us to get to know your father in a way that no one else could. You said that he was afraid to totally commit himself emotionally to other people and even to himself because opening himself up would leave him too vulnerable. Where do you think that fear came from?
You know, we actually spoke about it a couple of times, and he said as a kid, this is his words to me, that he was kind of sickly and had adenoids, I think they're called, and some other stuff going on. And the doctor would try to fix it, and it was very painful, evidently. And he would cringe away from it. And in his words, it started him cringing away from a number of things in life. I think that's a bunch of, in my opinion, actors leave themselves, good actors leave themselves extremely vulnerable to pretty much everything, because observation is really the fundamental of the craft. And unless you are vulnerable and open and constantly aware of things around you, you know, you're short shrift as an actor. And I think that causes shyness a great deal of time. You can see it in some of the great comedians. They're very shy when they're not on stage. And I think it's true of some actors as well. And I think it was true of my father.
Well, I have a feeling that that fear of totally committing himself emotionally probably came from his own father. That's my hunch.
That too. And I think that passes down. But I don't think it's true of me. I think I kind of broke that chain, if you will. I have a very, very close relationship with my three children and adore them. And Pop and I had a wonderful relationship too. We were the very best of friends. But as far as father-son, there was a barrier, I think. We both realized it. And it was up to me to either accept or turn away, and I chose to accept. So we had a wonderful friendship, but like I said, there was a little bit of a wall in between. I didn't really explain that well, but I think you get what I'm saying.
Oh, no, I totally get it. Now, as you know, in many of your father's movies, he played a kind of wide-eyed, bewildered loser or just a typical everyday man, which was so endearing, made him very relatable and likable. Do you think any of that screen persona came from his own personality?
Oh, absolutely. He was the most fun guy you'll ever hang out with. I miss him so, so much. The times I had with him were some of the greatest times I've ever had in my life. He was my best friend. And gosh, he was funny. If you think he was funny on screen, he was even funnier off. We just had a blast together. And so, yes, absolutely. That affability, that vulnerability, that everyman quality. Well, he used to call himself America's sweetheart. So we'll include modesty, I think. A great deal of what you saw on screen was him off screen.
I've always felt that your dad had the saddest eyes I've ever seen. Do you think that deep down inside he was a little bit lonely?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And again, that harkens back to what, you know, we started this discussion with. You know, it's a tough way to make a living if you're good at it. And he was darn good at it. And so, yes, there was a great deal of loneliness, sadness, all of the emotions, as well as happiness and cheerfulness, regret, all that stuff ran deeply in the man, as it does, in my opinion, in any good actor.
Chris, I want to read you something you wrote about your father that really touched me. You said, and I'm quoting you here, "My father was at his happiest when he was working. He was driven to achieve, compelled always to push himself to make the next one bigger and better. The problem with dedicating oneself totally to work is that at the end of the day, that's all you have. Yes, the fame is enticing, the money is great, and the awards and adulation are exhilarating. But I don't think my dad ever asked himself if these rewards were worth the price of emotional deprivation. I loved the fact that my dad was a star, but I wanted him to be more of a father." You know, Chris, I think you perfectly articulated what every child of an overachieving parent feels like. Do you think your dad knew that you felt that way?
That's a tough question, Harvey. I don't know. I know that I did. Those words that I wrote are true, and I do believe that. And again, it's part of the complexity of human relationship. You know, we are very complicated critters, and we carry a lot of stuff with us. And listen, I'm not, as I say in the intro to my second book, which I just finished writing, I'm not going to complain about my life. I have had a wonderful, wonderful life. Have I been dealt a few tough cards? Yeah. Haven't we all? But it's our choice as to how we choose to play those cards. And Jack Lemmon was a wonderful man. He had some shortcomings and had shortcomings as a father, but a lot of those were forced on him. Divorce, the second marriage. I try to be as candid and honest as I can, not only with my readers, my beloved readers, but with myself. And that's the truth, you know? That's why I chose to sort of leave Hollywood and come to the country and raise my kids here. I felt it was more important to have a relationship with my kids. And I can say, after I'm sure we're going to talk about it in a minute, what I've been through, I am very, very grateful that I made that choice.
Oh, we're going to talk about that for sure. Are there any prominent characteristics of your own personality that you inherited from your dad?
Oh, sure. I'm absolutely in love with myself. No, I think I'm very funny. Yes, I'm kidding. But no, I'm not. But anyway, yes, I'm very, the lemon didn't fall far from the tree. I'm very much my father's son. And I love being jocular and irreverent and outspoken, and I make a complete idiot of myself all the time, and relish in it, which he did. And that was what was so wonderful about him. He was, you know, he just would, as I say in the book, he would trip headfirst over the finish line to make the touchdown or win the race. And yes, I'm very much my father's son. Yeah. I could keep going because I also talk too much, just like my father.
Well, I have to say, I wouldn't change one thing about you. I love the fact that you are reminiscent of your father. We see aspects of him in you, but you also have your own very endearing qualities. You know, you said in your book that when you were growing up, being constantly referred to as Jack Lemmon's son was like a monkey on your back, and it led to a serious identity problem. And I would imagine that being known as Jack Lemmon's son created some unique challenges for you as an actor because of the constant comparisons. How did you cope with that?
In the end, it came down to a choice of not even trying to cope with it, accepting it, and saying, this is the hand I've been dealt. This is the way it is. So either I can panic and run, or I can do something unthinkable, like, you know, just choose to opt out, which has unfortunately happened to some children of famous people, not necessarily celebrities, but famous people in general. But or you can choose to play the cards you're dealt. And life is so precious. I've you know, in my wise old age, I've really come to realize it's a wonderful, wonderful gift. And does it come along with some, you know, some tough knocks? Sure. I don't mean to be redundant, but yes, it does. And it's your choice, my choice, as to how you deal with that. And yes, my father was forced into a certain place by his life and his choices. It was my choice to either let that become a falling out between us or to accept it and have a rich and wonderful relationship, which I did, with him and with my own children, which has become my greatest joy, to be here and to see my children becoming the men and women that they are becoming.
Your father was not a believer in nepotism, and he felt that you should make a success of yourself as an actor without his help. But did he ever give you any acting advice?
No, that was all verboten. And it wasn't just because of him and the way that and his relationship with his father, but it was also because of, divorce, second marriages, and influence from other people. You get what I'm saying. I was a stepchild in the true sense of the word. I was relegated to the front step. That carried over into a number of different things, and most especially my profession, and which happened to be his profession too. I mean, this is the only business where, it's nepotism if you follow in your father's footsteps. Yeah, it's any other business is expected, I didn't say that right, but again, you get it.
People go into the family business.
Yeah.
All the time, but it's considered
not in this business, baby.
That's right. It's considered nepotism.
It's the bite of the adder if you attempt to follow. And, what am I going to do? I'm his kid. I'm just like him. I'm taller, but other than that, I was a clone. And I that's okay because I loved my father and I'm happy with the way I've turned out. There's a lot of rough edges, but there's nothing wrong with being yourself. unless you happen to be in showbiz. Now, that being said, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of fine actors who have succeeded. In my case, unfortunately, that didn't happen because it wasn't allowed to happen by the people that came into my father's life after my mother and father were divorced.
And that's very, very hard to digest. It's interesting he didn't give you acting advice, but I understand that one piece of advice he gave you, if you can call it advice, he said, son, there's a lot of assholes out there. What did you make of that comment?
He's right. My father, I don't know, can we use irreverent language on your show, Harvey?
Absolutely.
Oh, we can. Okay. Well, the way he used to tell me that he loved me was to say, go fuck yourself. So that's my father, you know. He had a number of platitudes, but he never held back. So yeah, that was one piece of advice he did give me. I think that where I've tried to go in my life is convert them, man. Don't just say they're assholes. Convert them. Get them, you know, say... Now, this is all, listen, I mean, you know, who am I? The Pope? I don't know, you know, but, you know, you can tell one when you see one. And I try to make it better for everybody around me, because by doing that, I make it better for me. And so, yes, there are a lot of assholes out there, but I'm on a mission. I'm going to make them all good guys and gals.
That's a gift, believe me. You got to work with your dad in That's Life with Julie Andrews, directed by her husband, Blake Edwards. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was, you know, because that was really actually, I was busy. I was doing duet at the time, so I could only be on the set a little bit. But the times that I was, you know, we, instead of the father-son thing, along with it, we were actors together, working together, and it was a family affair. It was all the Edwards and the Lemon clan. So yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. It's interesting. It reminds me of the one, you know, we all have made mistakes, and I made one of the biggest mistakes I've ever made in my life. I wrote a script. It was a good script called Publicity Stunt. And I was trying to get it made. And all of a sudden, one day, Blake calls me up, Blake Edwards, and says, hey, kid, I didn't think you had it in you. I sound like my father doing that. Is she doing UBHA? Blake calls up and says, I didn't think you had it in you, Lem. And I said, what? He said, your script, it's good. I'd like to direct it. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, let's get your pop and Walter to do it. It was a buddy film. And I said, oh, God, I've got so-and-so is attached. And Blake said, are you kidding me? And we never got it made. God.
Well, that's such a shame.
Would that have been a hoot? Because it was a fun script. Pop loved it. And I just, it was one of those things where in life, you look back and go, you idiot. Are you kidding me? Blake Edwards directing, you know, Pop and Mathau in the script you wrote. Are you nuts?
That really is a shame. Is it too late for you to revive the script and star in it yourself with someone else?
Well, I wanted to, but at this point, unfortunately... some stuff has put a little bit of a damper on my stamina, shall we say, as far as working goes.
As I said in my introduction, you actually portrayed your father in a film called Blonde on the set of Some Like It Hot, and you were all made up as the Daphne character. That must have been a surreal experience for you.
I wasn't a big fan of the film, and I did not like the director. We did the entire ending of Some Like It Hot exactly as Pop and Joey did it in the film, the entire 5 minutes. We did it in one. We did it in one take. The crew actually went into applause, you know, because it was 2 a.m. and they thought, oh shit, we're going to be here all night long with this. And we got it on the first take, and he cut it out. He took it out.
What a mistake.
The film was a piece of shit. So how do you really feel about it, Chris?
Well, just for the clarity for our viewers, you are not talking about Some Like It Hot. You're talking about Blonde.
Right. No, Some Like It Hot is the greatest comedy of all time. That's right. AFI called it the greatest comedy of all time, and they were right. It's one of the greatest films ever made. No, this is Blonde, which was just a travesty.
What was it weird playing Daphne?
No. What was it? I gotta be honest with you. We can't get married at all. No, I do a good Jack Lemmon.
You know, yes,
I did
you
it on
certainly
stage for 4 years. Yeah, you know, I was, we were sold out at the St. James in London with me. You know, I did my Twist of Lemon when I turned it into a stage play. I did it in his voice. I did it as him. And yeah, I do a good Jack Lemmon.
That would be an understatement. Now, you know, I'm going to take you back to something you said a couple of minutes ago. You said that at a certain point in your career, despite your success as an actor, you and your wife decided to leave Hollywood, move to Connecticut. And you wrote this in your book. You said, I hate LA. I hate what it did to me. I'm angry because it betrayed me. What did you mean by that? How were you betrayed?
It's the whole point of the book. I mean, you think I talk a lot. Answering that question, we'll be here all day. But it's loss of innocence is really the basis of the best answer I can give you for that. And that was a big sub theme in Twist of Lemon, the book. And the play. LA was that, you know, beach blanket bingo and President Kennedy, you know, showing up for a swim and playing football on the beach. And, you know, and Dewey Weber was the lifeguard in front of my house. It was this magical. Marilyn lived 3 doors down, you know, and she'd come out and play her ukulele and hang out with the bonfires. You know, it was Camelot. And then it left. And that sparked in me a great sense. I did feel betrayed. I felt such a loss. I wanted the old Los Angeles back. Now, was that me maturing and the world changing from my perspective? Or was it actually the world changing? And as I ruminate in the book, I think it was a little bit of both. In this era of instant communication, you know, the atrocities, I don't know if they always existed, but they certainly do now. And they're on TV every night, and you're reminded of all the mistakes that we're making when we've been given such a gift. And that's, you know, the ether that I was trying to describe with that statement.
Well, you sure did the right thing to get out of there. You mentioned that you wrote and starred in a one-man show based on your book. You took the show on tour for almost 5 years, including a highly successful run at the St. James Theatre in London. But you didn't tell us. What inspired you to do that?
Money. I'm kidding. It was a search for catharsis began the whole thing when Pop died. I lost my best friend. And that's what began me just, I found when I wrote down memories, 1, 2, 3, 4, it would help. It would, you know, I'd remember, I'd smile. It would help me through. I adored him. I felt enormous loss. And then the book did well, and I was proud of it. And I thought, geez, it's not a movie, because it's narrative based. Its narrative base was me telling a story. So, you know, I mean, it worked great for the Stephen King film, but, you know, it would all be, you need to see an actor act. You know, it can't be me going, and I remember when my dad and I. So I knew it wasn't that. And I thought, gosh, maybe a stage piece, one person stage piece. And then the light bulb was, and I'll do it in my father's voice. I'll become my father. I'll do a little intro. And then all of a sudden, Daisy Bear, turn into Jack. For God's sakes, will you pull yourself together, please? Because people are talking.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. And it worked. It took me a while on the road. That's why it was such a long run. I, you know, the first year or two, I was trying to find it, and then I did. And that was right before the St. James. And we went and did the St. James, and lovely Hugh Woolridge directed me. And we just had a 5-week run and just knocked it out of the park. And it remains, for me, probably the most rewarding experience I had as an artist, because it was all me, all mine. I from the bottom up, from the asphalt up. But the one regret, of course, was that Pop didn't see it.
What do you think he would have thought of it?
Well, I think he would have gone for it. Yeah, yeah.
What a great way to honor him.
You know, Jack Lemmon, watching an hour and a half of Jack Lemmon, he would have loved it.
Well, you honored him so beautifully in the book. I would love to have seen your one-man show. Now, we also mentioned a little earlier, you're in the process of finalizing a new book called My Lemon Lungs, which I've had the great privilege of reading. The book deals with the impact of your major health scare that required you to have a double lung transplant about 5 years ago. First of all, Chris, how are you feeling now?
Yeah, I'm okay. I mean, you know, getting a new set of tires will certainly get your attention. But I've made it 5 years. That's sort of for lung transplant is the scariest one of all of them, because it's the only organ that remains exposed to the environment. Obviously, you got to breathe. So you're constantly breathing in stuff that can kill you. The two things that someone will succumb to after a transplant are rejection and infection. And rejection is because the body considers the transplant a foreign object, it tries to get rid of it. And that's just the way it is. And especially, again, true of lung transplants. So you have to take some just nasty stuff every day for the rest of your life to keep your immune system down. And considering all that, it's unfortunate, but it's a 50-50 shot after lung transplant that you'll make it 5 years. And I have. Last Thanksgiving, I turned 5. I had my fifth lung-iversary, and I am very happily still here. Unfortunately, a few of the guys that were done the same time as me are not. And so it's rough, but hey, it's good to be here.
Oh, and it's wonderful to know that you're doing well. I'm so grateful that we're all still blessed to have you here. You know, Chris, you really had a miracle happen. You needed a double lung transplant, and the lungs that you needed showed up 1 hour before you would have died. Yes. Do you believe in destiny, or do you think that your good luck was just a random thing?
No, I do believe in destiny. But I do believe that we create a great deal of our own destiny as well, which harkens back to all the things we've been talking about. Yes, it was, there's whatever you want to call it. I believe in frequency and vibration and energy. I believe that those are the core of the universe. And as the core of us, as well. So what you project is what you get. And, you know, you have to want something to happen. Not want. I'm sorry. That's the wrong word. You have to manifest. You manifest what you want to receive, because it's not a question of wanting. It's a question of it simply is. It becomes because you are it. And I was not ready to die. I'm not ready to die now. I got a horrible disease called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. It has nothing to do with smoking, or I don't smoke. I don't drink. I don't do any of that. I'm a big bore. But I got this IPF. Idiopathic means they don't know why you got it either. I ruminate about it, as you know, in my book. I think we do a lot of things to ourselves, and I think a lot of things are the result of the baggage we carry. And I think that, you know, a lot of that was that I blame myself my entire life for my mother and father divorcing. It was my fault. And I think I carried that. And I think that it, along with genetics and with just stuff, it manifested as IPF. They don't know why you get it. It's certainly an autoimmune thing of some sort that happens for some reason. I think there was some physical stuff going on as well. I had an accident on a set that caused me to get a hiatal hernia. That could have had a lot to do with it in my lungs as well. But all of that put together, do I believe there were some angels around me? You betcha, I do. I do, and I really do.
There absolutely are guardian angels around you. I don't know if you know that I am a retired family and criminal court judge. Did you know that?
I did know that, yes.
So I just want
to do my due diligence just like you.
And I appreciate it. I mention it, Chris, because the one most common comment I received in 26 years of being on the bench from children of divorced parents was that they really believed it was their fault, that they had something to do with the fact that their parents broke up. And it's heartbreaking because we all know as adults that it has nothing to do with the children. Even when parents are fighting about custody, they're not fighting about the children, because nobody in their right mind would ask a total stranger, a judge, to decide where their children are going to live. But they can't put their children's best interests ahead of their own anger and their own need to wage a war with each other because they want vengeance. And I just, when I read that in your book, I wanted to give you such a big hug and tell you that I hope you finally let go of that. It had nothing to do with you.
I didn't. I can't. I know. I can logic it out. But no, I'll never let go of that pain of what happened with the divorce and my father's second marriage, and consequently my entire life in that compartment of my life. However, I was able to, you know, bravo for me, learn from that experience and that pain and create a life for myself and my family, along with my beautiful bride, Gina, and our three kids and our two dogs. We have a blessed, a God-given life. And, I am, you know, here I am all of a sudden. I can't go anywhere. I'm a boy in a bubble, you know. I mean, I'm completely immune suppressed. I can be here in what we created in this beautiful place in Connecticut with my kids and with my dogs and with my wife. You know, it's amazing how things work out sometimes. Play the hand, man. Whatever they deal you, you play it. And if it's not the right cards, you make those cards the right cards.
Boy, you just said a mouthful. That's so true. Now, in your new book, Chris, which I hope everyone will want to read when it comes out.
If I can get published, the last one did pretty good.
It did very well. I recommend it highly. It's one of the best Hollywood memoirs I've ever read. Now, in this new book, you've gone into a bit more detail about the dynamic involving your father's second wife, Felicia Farr, whom you described as extremely controlling and who isolated your dad from his closest friends and even from you. Do you think at some point he regretted marrying her?
It's not for me to say. She isolated him from his own daughter, her daughter. I'm not talking about a great person here.
But I was shocked to learn. I'm just going to say this. I was shocked to learn that your father left you and his three grandchildren nothing in his will. How could he possibly have let that happen?
He left me $100,000 along with Court, my sister, who I adore, and Felicia's daughter. It's just a shame. He was such a great guy. And I think that in the end, to answer your question, Harvey, yes, I think he did regret it. But he would never have said that. Again, you know, this was not a guy who, you know, wore his heart on his coat sleeve. He was very, very guarded emotionally, unless he was on camera. And listen, this is just my opinion. So it is what it is. But I know how deeply my life was affected. And that is the one thing that I just can't. You know, I keep saying that you have to create your own. You have to vibrate with the right frequencies to make reality what you want it to be. And I do believe that, but I can't get rid of that one. That's a piece of baggage I'm just going to carry.
Now, in reading both of your books, there are, in my opinion, two major themes that run through your writing. Number one, your search for your father's approval. So let me ask you, Chris, did you finally get it?
There was yes and no. No, because he was morphed into a different man by the time he passed away, in my opinion, by her. But yes, there were times when, also, I don't know about the whole acting thing, whether he thought I was any good or not. I know I am. I know what I did at the St. James in London. I know what I did for 5 weeks straight to packed, sold out houses every night. I know what I did. And I don't know if he thought I was any good or if he was talked into that or whatever the hell happened in those drunken evenings, you know, before he turned sober. She never did. She finally turned sober in her 80s after he was gone. But you imagine that? The guy went AA and she didn't.
It's heartbreaking.
Put this tarnish on this lovely interview. It is what it is. We're dealt our hands.
But it's very eye-opening. It's actually quite moving to me because we just had Frank Sinatra's daughter, Tina, on our show last week. And she had a lot to say about her father's final wife.
Well, who's a good friend of Felicia's? How do you like them apples?
She had a lot to say about Barbara Sinatra and what she did to Frank and to the rest of the family. And I'm hearing this now and I'll move on, but I want you to know my heart is with you. I was in
thank
family.
You're a lovely, lovely man. And I really thank you for that. It means a lot. Yeah, they were a clan, you know, Felicia and Barbara and a few others.
Well, I mentioned that there were two themes that ran through your books. The second theme we already talked about, which is this persistent feeling that's really killing me, that somehow you were to blame for your parents' divorce. You're almost 70, and I really hope that at some point you will finally accept once and for all I mean, deep down inside, that your parents' divorce had absolutely nothing to do with you, because I don't believe they would ever have wanted you to feel that way.
No, I never
met a divorced couple, and I saw the worst of the worst that would come to court. Mm. Never did I meet a divorced couple, even who did the most evil things to each other. Never did they ever want their children to feel bad about their breakup or responsible for it. So that was the other theme that ran through your book. And I just pray that one day you will be relieved of that nagging feeling, because it's not what they would have wanted for you at all.
Thank you so much. And I know that my mother worked very hard through her very short life. She was taken from us way too early. And I think a lot of it was, you know, from stuff she carried inside. But she died from cancer at 62. But she was an amazing woman. She, as I tell the story in the book very briefly, she wanted to see One Last Christmas because that was her favorite holiday. And she did. And we were all there with her, and she died the morning after. That's strength, man. That's it, because she was supposed to die months and months before. That's strength.
She willed herself. She willed herself. She manifested exactly what you said. And you have that in you. And I hope you know, I mean, you have three children. I hope that you truly have found that healing and that redemption within your own soul, just knowing that you have been a much better father to your children than your father was to you. That's a fact.
That's exactly where I was going. I think I have. And I think that a lot of it had to do with this illness and making it through and willing myself, because it's been a rough go. There was about three times in the last 5 years that I've almost succumbed, and it was will, it was strength. It was that willing myself to live, because I want to live. I want to be around this wonderful life that I've had a hand in creating, along with my wife and my kids and this place and my friends and, you know, all that stuff. So yes, I think I have. There's one thing I just can't forgive, which is her. And I'm sure that Tina said the same thing. She had every right to, in my opinion. But other than that, I'm at peace. I'm good, man. And I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm just too tough. They can't kill me. They can try, but they ain't going to get me.
Oh, you've been through the worst of it.
Clint Eastwood. Yeah.
You've been through the worst of it. You are doing well. You will continue. The world needs you. I want to tell you, Chris, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and having this chance to explore really in some depth who you really are, because quite clearly you're so much more than the son of Jack Lemmon. Thank you for writing your books. Thank you for believing in yourself and your family enough to survive one of the worst imaginable health crises that anybody could ever have. And of course, thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show. I've loved every minute of our time together.
Harvey, you are such a lovely and thoughtful and caring person and really good in what you do. It's been my pleasure entirely.
Thank you so much. Please come back to the show when the second book comes out.
You got it.
Our guest has been the wonderful Chris Lemmon, whose book, A Twist of Lemon, A Tribute to My Father, is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. Please be on the lookout for his new book, My Lemon Lungs, A Memoir, which will be released later this year, hopefully. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.